class Brazilians are saying they identify with most. Camila Escalante, Pernambuco.
Finally, after weeks of divisive debates and bitter infighting, Britain's ruling Conservative Party has elected a new leader, Liz Truss, who also goes on to become the next Prime Minister, ending a power vacuum at number 10, which led to public fear and economic uncertainty. Truss was officially appointed after meeting Queen Elizabeth II at Balmoral Tuesday morning. Her predecessor, Boris Johnson, had earlier issued his final speech outside number 10 ahead of resigning his post.
This is it, folks. Thank you, everybody, for coming out so early this morning. In only a couple of hours, I will be in Balmoral to see Her Majesty the Queen. And the torch will finally be passed to a new Conservative leader.
Truss has secured the faith of the Tory membership. However, polling suggests the Conservatives have lost favour with the wider electorate. But Truss supporters believe she has what it takes to turn things around.
Liz Truss wasn't responsible for the mess that the country is now in. Indeed, Rishi Sunak, her rival as Chancellor of the Exchequer, he was behind many of the policies which involved an increase in the national insurance, basically a tax on jobs, and of course inflationary policies that have exacerbated the crisis that Britain is currently in. So Liz Truss will be a new broom that will come in and perhaps sweep up the mess that Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson, her predecessor as Prime Minister, created.
Allegations have been spread of a possible plan by Boris on returning to power, agitating from the backbenches to undermine Truss's leadership, as he did under David Cameron and Theresa May.
Boris Johnson, to be honest, I met him and he is like unpredictable. He can do anything. I think at the moment he will be away for a while, but he must have a plan. Always he have a plan. Boris, he like stay for a little while, then he have something else. So he's not going to stop for sure.
Truss's first big challenge will be dealing with the cost of living crisis. She's pledged a clear plan within a week, with expectations of a cap freeze on energy bills. But winter looms and bills remain eye-wateringly high.
Even before Truss took office, speculation has swirled regarding whether she has what it takes or not to save the economy, fight off backbench criticism, and also to hold on to power for the Conservatives in a general election, the next being scheduled for January 2025, meaning that Truss will have to make a meaningful impact and quickly in order to hold on to her position at number 10 for the long term. Robert Carter, London.
The Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in August 2021 brought about rapid and momentous changes to the country's economy, which was already reeling under the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, persistent insecurity, and weakened private sector confidence. Following the power shift, the war-torn country's economic activities were greatly affected, with the private sector being hit hard. Many private firms have experienced a drastic decline in consumer demand for their products and services. A survey by the World Bank shows that many firms in Afghanistan are adjusting to the new business environment, but most are still facing daunting challenges. The majority of private firms have responded to those challenges by laying off employees, shifting to cash and informal payment channels, shrinking investments, and lowering staff salaries.
Today, factories are facing a lot of problems, especially with raw materials, oil, and power. In our factory, we did our best to continue work. However, we were forced to reduce the number of our employees from 120 to 60. We also made some changes to salaries. We're trying to survive at any cost in this harsh situation so that we can help some people put food on their tables and make ends meet.
The survey has also found that employment remained around 50% lower than before August 2021. Most firms are operating below their full capacity and are only considered partially open. This, as U.S. sanctions have disrupted international payments and limited access to bank accounts and formal banking.
The biggest challenges the Afghan private sector is facing are the new government's unrecognized status and banking problems. You know that Afghanistan is importing raw materials from abroad, but today our business people are unable to transfer their money. The cruel sanctions are not posing any pressure on the ruling Taliban, but on the private firms and the welfare of our people. Our country needs to be considered as a member of the global village once again and start interacting with the world.
In the meantime, the new survey confirms the resilience of Afghanistan's private sector, which can play a key role in the economic recovery of the country and improving the livelihood of the Afghan people.
Private sector firms in Afghanistan are impacted by the loss of international assistance and banking relationships. Business people here are calling for positive cooperation between the Taliban and global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
For the first time since the beginning of the UN brokered agreement in April, Yemenis are waiting in long lines in front of a limited number of operating petrol stations in the capital Sana'a to refill their vehicles. Yemen is suffering from a fresh fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's ongoing blockade.
The Saudi-led coalition wasn't sincere in implementing the terms of the armistice, and it did not open flights to other destinations from Sana'a Airport, and the salary issue still persists. The enemy is still using various methods to pressure the Yemenis, such as seizing fuel ships. But our leadership is studying the positions that can be taken regarding the Saudi violations of the UN armistice. There will be an appropriate decision at the right time, as the leadership is keen to move towards a solution to end the war.
The Yemeni Petroleum Company announced the implementation of the emergency plan and is distributing fuel to a few stations only. It held the United Nations responsible for the consequences of the Saudi violation, as it did not ensure the implementation of the armistice terms that included allowing fuel ships to enter Yemen without any restrictions.
The fuel crisis that the liberated areas are experiencing contradicts the United Nations statements that there is a smooth flow of entry of fuel ships into the port of Hodeidah. If there had been a smooth entry, we would not have experienced this crisis. The UN is a clear partner in decision posed on the Yemeni people because it did not force a Saudi-led coalition to implement what was agreed upon. We hold the United Nations responsible for the continued violations of the Saudi-led coalition.
Since the beginning of the truce, only 33 fuel ships out of 54 have entered the country. However, Riyadh is still holding 9 fuel ships despite them obtaining UN permits, and this is a clear violation of the UN brokered agreement.
Observers believe that the Saudi seizure of oil ships and the Yemeni army's recent military parades indicate a return to military escalation. They say the UN brokered truce has failed to achieve tangible results in relieving the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Liz Truss has begun celebrations after winning the race to become the new leader of the ruling Conservative Party, making her the next British Prime Minister, beating her rival finalist Rishi Sunak and taking over the post from her predecessor Boris Johnson. The Foreign Secretary, who won 81,326 votes of Tory members to the former Chancellor's 60,000, takes over from Boris Johnson, who was ousted by his own MPs earlier this summer.
I'd like to pay tribute to my fellow candidates, particularly Rishi Sunak. It's been a hard-fought campaign. I think we have shown the depth and breadth of talent in our Conservative Party. Friends and colleagues, thank you for putting your faith in me to lead our great Conservative Party, the greatest political party on earth.
The feeling of joy over her victory will not last long. Truss has taken over a car crash economy and a so-called zombie government. Building a new cabinet, formulating an effective energy plan, and figuring out how to remove pressure of the severe cost of living crisis are all top of the agenda.
Things in Britain do need to change. We need some new policies, because what's been happening recently is there's a cost of living crisis, an energy crisis. Inflation is at its highest amount for several decades now, and this is alarming. Britain's economic future is quite bleak. Businesses are suffering. indeed, there could be the position that many factories may have to close, perhaps temporarily, because simply they cannot afford the fuel bills. So something, in a sense, must be done.
Truss inherits a deeply divided party. Lagging in the polls and a long line of past scandals have left many experts fearing lasting damage to Tory electoral prospects.
Truss won't officially take over until Tuesday after a meeting with the Queen alongside the outgoing Mr. Johnson. However, her next big fight will be to convince the wider electorate that her premiership has a future. Robert Carter, London.
Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to mark the first anniversary of the Gilboa prison break, also known as the Freedom Tunnel operation. In September of last year, 6 Palestinian detainees escaped from the Gilboa maximum security prison in occupied northern Palestine. They managed to get out through an underground tunnel in the prison's drainage system. Hamas resistance movement has vowed to secure the release of Palestinian detainees.
On the first anniversary of the heroic Gilboa escape operation, we salute the 6 prisoners. Securing the release of all prisoners is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. The 6 escapees will be on top of the list of any future prisoner swap deals with the Zionist entity.
The Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the 4th Geneva Convention. The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions. The prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Palestinian prisoners escape from Israeli prisons because of the horrible detention conditions. They suffer from inhumane treatment, and hundreds of prisoners are held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention.
Palestinian prisoners regularly go on hunger strikes and protest at the regime's administrative detention policy and harsh conditions. Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
We call on all international human rights organizations to step in and protect Palestinian prisoners. There are thousands of prisoners, including children and women, in Israeli custody. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from all forms of oppression inside Israeli jails.
Currently, around 5,000 Palestinians, including children and women, are languishing inside Israeli jails.
People here consider Palestinians held in Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters who continue to struggle under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In the limelight.
Before Sarah Matthews, a former Deputy White House Press Secretary, even opened her mouth to testify on Thursday, 21st of July, before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th assault on the Capitol, the House Republican Conference attacked her on Twitter as a liar and a pawn of Democrats. The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by Annie Carney and Maggie Haberman, two journalists writing for the New York Times. The piece is titled, In January 6 Hearings, Gender Divide Has Been Strong Undercurrent. Before Sarah Matthews, a former Deputy White House Press Secretary, even opened her mouth to testify on Thursday, 21st of July, before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6 assault on the Capitol, the House Republican Conference attacked her on Twitter as a liar and a pawn of Democrats. The group did not mention the man seated beside her, Matthew Pottinger, the former Deputy National Security Advisor, who was also there to issue a scathing indictment of President Donald J. Trump's behavior on the day of the riot. Nor did Donald Trump himself mention Mr. Pottinger when he lashed out hours later with a statement calling Sarah Matthews a fame seeker who was clearly lying. The contrast highlighted how, in a series of revelatory hearings that have focused on issues of democracy, the rule of law and the peaceful transfer of power, another less discussed theme has emerged. The gender dynamics that have been a potent undercurrent. In the course of exposing Donald Trump's elaborate effort to overturn the 2020 election, the House Select Committee has relied on the accounts of several women who came forward to publicly tell their stories. Their statements and the attacks that ensued laid bare how women often still pay a higher price than men for speaking up. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming and the vice chairwoman of the panel, a woman who herself has suffered heavy consequences for her insistence on publicly condemning Donald Trump's conduct, has been explicit about the role of gender in the proceedings. She has positioned herself as a champion of the women who have agreed to testify in public, comparing them favorably with the many men who have refused to do so. At the committee's primetime hearing on Thursday, 21st of July, Liz Cheney wore a white jacket, the colour of the women's suffrage movement. She invoked Margaret Thatcher, the first woman to serve as Prime Minister of Britain, and the fight by American women to secure the right to vote, as she described the women who had publicly appeared during the panel's investigation as an inspiration to American women and American girls. She was referring to Sarah Matthews as well as Cassidy Hutchinson, another White House aide who appeared at one of the committee's hearings. Caroline Edwards, a Capitol police officer who testified about how she was assaulted by the rioters, sustained a concussion and continued to fight them off. And Wandria Moss and her mother, Ruby Freeman, election workers from Georgia, who told the panel about how they endured harassment and even death threats after Donald Trump named them in a false conspiracy theory about voter fraud. The result has been that as the committee unfurls the story of the January 6 attack, playing footage of a mostly male crowd laying waste to the Capitol in Donald Trump's name, with the president looking on supportively from the West Wing. Many of the witnesses who have emerged most prominently have been women, with Liz Cheney as their defender. It is a notable strategy by Liz Cheney, a tough and hawkish conservative who throughout her career has worked to avoid being viewed through the lens of gender. It comes as the Republican Party has labored to diversify and expand its appeal among female voters, a group that polls showed was a weak spot for Donald Trump in 2020 and has only drifted from him since. A recent New York Times Siena College poll found that 6 in 10 women believed Mr. Trump's actions after the 2020 election threatened democracy, while men were almost evenly split, with 48% holding that view and 45% saying he was just exercising his rights. Liz Cheney was the highest-ranking Republican woman on Capitol Hill last year when she broke with her party after the riot and called out Donald Trump and his election lies, voting to impeach him for incitement of insurrection. Within months, she had been ousted as the number 3 Republican in the House, and she is now at risk of losing her seat in Wyoming, as she faces a challenging primary election next month against a Trump-endorsed opponent. It was difficult not to hear some parallels when Liz Cheney described on Thursday how Cassidy Hutchinson, the 26-year-old former White House aide who became a critical public witness, knowingly exposed herself to harsh criticism from former colleagues. Ms. Cheney said that Ms. Hutchinson knew all along that she would be attacked by President Trump and by the 50, 60, and 70-year-old men who hide themselves behind executive privilege. But like our witnesses today, she has courage and she did it anyway, Liz Cheney added. After Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony, Donald Trump dismissed her in an interview with Newsmax as this girl who was making up stories. "She's got serious problems, let me put it that way," he said, "mental problems." Amanda Carpenter, a former advisor to Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Jim DeMint of South Carolina, both Republicans, said it was notable to see a conservative woman drawing attention to the gender dynamic. "I know how hard it is for these women under these circumstances," Ms. Carpenter said. "I imagine it means a lot to the women being targeted. It means a lot to me just watching it." The Twitter attack by the House Republican Conference on Sarah Matthews, who works as a House Republican aide, was quickly deleted. But Donald Trump's targeting of her and Cassidy Hutchinson was in line with how the former president has often publicly treated women who challenge him, criticizing them in personal terms intended to call into question their credibility, their sanity and self-worth. Donald Trump's allies like to describe him as an equal opportunity counterpuncher who would attack anyone who crossed him. But over the years, he has singled out female antagonists with particular viciousness, including the television personalities Mika Brzezinski and Megyn Kelly, Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, and Mary T. Barra, the chief executive of General Motors. His allies, many of them seeking his approval, have mimicked his behaviour. In the case of Cassidy Hutchinson, a person close to her said, "Stories have been shopped to Trump-friendly media outlets, smearing her personally." Garrett Ziegler, a junior aide in Donald Trump's White House, went on a misogynistic rant during a live stream this past week after sitting for an interview with the January 6th committee in which he repeatedly refused to answer questions. In the rant, he used sexist slurs against his former female colleagues who have cooperated with the inquiry. Pat Cipollone, Bill Barr, Mark Short, they're saying the same thing. "Yet you attack the young women," said former Representative Barbara Comstock of Virginia, a Republican whom Mr. Trump, in the past, branded as a rhino loser, for Republican in name only. Barbara Comstock was referring to the former White House counsel, the former Attorney General, and the former Chief of Staff to Vice President Mike Pence, all of whom gave closed-door testimony to the committee that painted Donald Trump in an unflattering light. "This is a pattern," said Barbara Comstock, who is close to Liz Cheney. "The president does this, and this is intentional." Some of the male witnesses have also suffered professional consequences and public rebukes for their candor. Rusty Bowers, the Arizona House Speaker and a Republican, was censured by his state's Republican Party after his emotional testimony before the committee. Mr. Bowers, who is running for re-election, told NBC News that it would take a miracle for him to survive politically. And William Barr, who as Attorney General directly told Donald Trump that his claims of election fraud had no merit, echoed the sentiment about the realities of cooperation. "I get a lot of vitriol from the right," William Barr said in a brief interview. Yet while male witnesses have received some criticism from the right, in Mr. Cipollone's case, Donald Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., tweeted that he should grow a spine and go on record. The attacks have not been at the same volume or intensity or of the same degree of personal nastiness as those against Cassidy Hutchinson in particular. Donald Trump's allies insist they have substantive concerns about what Cassidy Hutchinson has told the committee. "They have raised specific challenges on matters of fact in her testimony, honing in on a discrepancy between her account and that of Eric Hirschman, a former White House lawyer. Each has claimed authorship of a handwritten note displayed at one of the hearings that provided instructions for what the president could have told the rioters on 6 of January 2021. There has also been an effort to undermine the veracity of some of the most explosive parts of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony. Secret Service officials who spoke to reporters on the condition of anonymity disputed a scene that Ms. Hutchinson said that she had been told about, in which Donald Trump was said to have grabbed a Secret Service agent and lunged for the steering wheel of the SUV he was riding in as he demanded to be driven to the Capitol on 6 of January 2021. But the swiftness of the Twitter attack on Sarah Matthews was notable given that it came from her own colleagues. The Twitter account for the House Republican conference that singled her out is run by two former Trump campaign aides. Under the stewardship of Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, who replaced Liz Cheney as the number three House Republican, the Twitter account has taken on an aggressive tone throughout the hearings, intended to please the proverbial audience of one.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran has not been subservient to the U.S. and has not become a vassal state. This explains why Iran's leader has hailed the Islamic Republic as the most promising force in the face of plots pursued by colonial powers, stating that most of their outrageous demands have been resisted and rejected due to Iran's resistance. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what kinds of demands the leader was talking about and why those demands and pressures have failed. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Marseille in France. Also joining us, journalist and political commentator Sir Mohsen Abbas, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, first to you. One of the things that Iran's leader has said, Shia Muslims take great pride in standing up against arrogant powers which interfere in the affairs of other countries, governments, and nations in a cruel and tyrannical manner. Can you expand that for us, please?
Well, lying at the heart of
Iran, Islamic Republic of Iran, is an ideology. And this is what quite often both Western analysts, as well, those Western analysts who are antagonistic towards Iran, and Western politicians and Western media very conveniently forget that the Islamic Revolution was based on not only bringing down arrogant powers as manifested by the Shah of Iran, but it's also based on some fundamental values, the values of justice, the values of courage, and the values of fairness. These are just some of the values which, of course, Islam, which is at the heart of the Islamic Revolution's ideological stand, insists upon. And the leadership of Imam Khomeini, followed by the guidance of Rehbere Mukawama, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has kind of consolidated around these fundamental values. And when Ayatollah Khamenei therefore talks about the enmity of the arrogant powers, what he's talking about is a fundamental flaw in the system that lies certainly in the West. And that flaw is based on the lack of virtues. And the key one he picks out there is arrogance. And it is this arrogance which leads the West to try and subjugate Iran, which is its primary objective, by any means necessary. So subjugating Iran, of course, means economically, politically, ideologically. And they go about doing it through, and they have done it, through military means, through economic sanctions, and they've tried it through psychological operations, cultural wars. All of it has been rolled out, and we can go into more of the details of how that's been done.
Sure.
I think this is what Ayatollah Khamenei is talking about, that Iran's defense against that constant attack from all different forms has been a very successful one.
Okay. When we take a look at the way that Iran is actually viewed, Elijah Magnier, by the West, and in particular the U.S., obviously the U.S. has problems with Iran and what it stands for. Taking a close look, however, at what Iran stands for is not something that is out of the ordinary or is something outrageous. We're looking at, again, some of the statements made today, another which is about standing up to bullying, where Iran's leader described Iran's encouragement of other nations to stand up against bullying as the main reason behind what he said was arrogant powers, wrath, and enmity towards the Islamic Republic. What types of things do you think Iran's leader is talking about when he says standing up to bullying?
Well, actually, the Americans really don't care about the religion in Iran or in any other country, and they really are careless about the Sunni or the Shia or any other religion. They are mainly concerned about the country that is submitted to the U.S. hegemony or not submitted to the U.S. hegemony. And Iran, since 1979, showed that it is rejecting the U.S. or any other hegemony, even the Russian or any other country that is trying to impose its will on the Iranian population. So from that on, from that period onward, for America, Iran become an enemy state or a state to be you have to be break and bring to submission, and Iran should kneel to the American hegemony of the world, particularly after the fall of the Soviet Union. Iran remained with a very few countries like Cuba, and after that, many years later, Venezuela, who are rejecting the U.S. hegemony. So from that on, the Americans constructed 35 military bases around Iran in different countries in the Gulf. They even pushed Saddam Hussein to attack Kuwait through the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad. And they attack Iraq to cripple Iraq, but at the end of the day, to be on the border with Iran, because the aim was to submit Iran after Syria and Lebanon. So this is how the Americans understand how countries should function. And countries should function according to the U.S. policy and putting the U.S. Priority above any other priorities, including the national security of any country. We've seen this today happening in Europe. So it is not surprising that the Americans consider Iran as an enemy. The only thing that the Americans want from Iran is just to accept it to Germany, and then Iran can be the leader of all the nations in the Middle East, and that would be extremely happy for the Americans to do, as long as Iran submit to the Americans. And we've seen today with the nuclear deal, Iran is showing that its national interests come first and not the U.S. hegemony.
So following that train of thought, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, we're looking at the fact that the U.S. Throughout the decades since the Islamic Revolution has not been able to obviously make Iran subservient to its foreign policy objectives, particularly in this region. And it has gone to, and it has subscribed to something that has really reared an ugly head way back, and it showed itself back in 2003, particularly, and that's the whole issue of sectarianism when the U.S. waged a war against Iraq. Tell us the way that the U.S. used that card, and how, what kind of function did Iran have in that to basically defeat the consequences that arose out of that U.S. push?
Well, this this notion of a Shia crescent popped up quite early on in this century, perhaps even slightly before. And initially, it was the Jordanians and the Arabs who were allied to the Americans who started pushing this idea of a Shia crescent. And that was the first time one heard of this kind of new narrative that was being pushed out ultimately by American intelligence agencies and all those that were allied to them. And it was really designed to create a fear, first of all, amongst Sunnis. So there was this sectarian effort to divide the Middle East along Shia and Sunni lines, and they went for it, and they still continue to go for it. It's, of course, it's kind of most vicious and venomous manifestations, of course, are Daesh and ISIS, who are well known across the world now to have been a kind of head-cutting, very ruthless, very nasty phenomena, which was actually on the verge of bringing Iraq down. It was certainly operating and still is operating to bring Syria down. It still is doing the same with Iraq. Those are just two theaters of its operation. Afghanistan, I could quote, perhaps even Libya and Yemen as well. But primarily, it's Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, its support of Hezbollah and its support of Assad in Syria, its support of Iraq in terms of trying to make sure that it has sovereignty, or these nations or these regions have their own sovereignty, which has actually prevented the American plots and plans to use Daesh, to use ISIS as a means of breaking the region. But at the heart of it was ISIS was handed an ideology. It was handed a kind of very extreme, very violent version of Wahhabism, which originates, of course, in those same Arab states which are propped up by the Americans and who are supported by them, like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, you know, all of these central nations, which all supported this nasty virus known as Daesh. But of course, it's failed largely because of the military actions of the Al-Quds force and many other reasons. But the Iranians have also countered with their own, of course, ability to be able to show people that there's another way. And the way is a successful model of Velayat-e Faqih, a successful model of Iran, which can actually challenge the hegemony.
Well, taking a look at this sectarian card, Elijah Magnier, it seems like something that they went for was the fact that they wanted to use sectarian tensions to ultimately try to divide the two, Sunnis and Shias, and to form an ethnic mapping, of which we heard that echoed by the now U.S. president, but former VP of the U.S., Joe Biden, when he went for the partition of Iraq. Was that a concerted effort by the U.S. to ultimately partition Iraq, as stated in the past by then VP of the U.S., Biden?
Well, the Americans failed to confront Iran and its allies in the Middle East. Therefore, it was in need of another enemy that can fight Iran and can fight all the allies of Iran without the U.S. interfering in the middle of the battle, but supplying from behind and allowing groups to fight each other by triggering the reason behind that. So the problem in the 12ers is they stand against injustice. and the Sunnis in general, they obey to the rulers. By having a group of people who stand against injustice, they are extremely dangerous, because what the Americans are bringing to the Middle East, they are bringing dominance, and they're bringing death and destruction and control. This is what they've done in Afghanistan for 20 years. This is what they've done in Iraq. And then in Iraq, they have failed. So the only way is to turn the Shia and the Sunni against one another. And we've seen in Iraq how the Shia resisted for many years not to respond to the extremist Sunni, who are not really Sunni, but they have a particular ideology that was exploited by the Americans. I remember Colin Powell saying that they have boosted the image of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who lived in Kurdistan before 2003, under the control of the U.S. forces. So they were very much aware of the weight of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, what he represented, and they inflated him because they needed him to confront the Shia. And this is what they done in Syria, by trying to blur the real narrative by saying that it is a sectarian war, when 70% of the Syrian army are Sunni fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And then we suddenly see, to prove the fake narrative of the Americans, that they claim it is Sunni Shia, when we've seen ISIS attacking Al-Qaeda, and they're both Sunni, both Wahhabis, and they both believe more or less in the same doctrine. So all this excuse by the Americans to bring the Islamophobia or the Shia phobia, or to bring the Sunni and the Shia together, has only one aim. It's a political aim. It's not a religious aim. But they found ground for that, and they supported, and they threw oil on fire, and they found who can listen to them, particularly when we see how the Americans supported Al-Qaeda in Syria, to understand that the objective of the Americans is not to defeat the extremists, but to support them as long as they serve their own objectives and purposes.
Well, it's very interesting the way that the whole approach of the U.S., Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, has been towards the terrorists that are Sunni. And I'm going to read off what I found to be something that was echoed on numerous sites. This one is from the Atlantic Council, in a report where it said, U.S. made Iran the U.S.'s top priority in the Middle East, allowing for America's great big counter-Sunni extremist machine. Now notice, it doesn't call them, the U.S. doesn't call them terrorists. It calls them Sunni extremist machine, to shift focus to Shia groups. And it goes on to say, Iranian-backed Shia militant groups have begun to be sanctioned more regularly, even those that had fought against Daesh. Now, can you believe that? It says the Shia groups who are fighting against Daesh, they're still terrorists. Can you please explain the logic there?
Well, there is no logic there. As we've recognized, that America has a very one-sided and very single-minded objective. It is to crush the Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership and its kind of governance structures until it actually does what America says, until it hands over its wealth, it hands over its sovereignty, hands over all of its kind of autonomy. The Americans and the Israelis, for that matter, won't rest. And of course, it's not just the card of the Shia Sunni that they've tried to play, because of course they know that Islamic Republic of Iran is predominantly Shia, although there's a very peaceful Sunni minority that lives in that region. There's a peaceful Jewish minority that lives there as well. But what they've tried to do is isolate Iran and try to create a propaganda that Iran is Shia, and it can never therefore be a leader of the Islamic world or the Western Asia, because it's fundamentally religiously different. Although the differences between the Shia and Sunni are absolutely minuscule in reality. Anybody who knows anything about religious depths knows that that's a fallacy to create that kind of level of division. But they've also used the Arab non-Arab card, don't forget. And with, again, Iranians and the whole notion of Persia and whatever, they tried to also use that to accentuate the difference of Iranians from the Arabs. They've tried to create intra-Shia conflicts. As you talked about intra-Sunni conflicts and the wars that have been going on between those groups and the parties, I mean, Libya was not a Shia-Sunni crisis. Again, it had a completely different dynamic. Syria was nothing to do with that. But this intra-Shia fighting, they've sponsored certain groups within Iran and outside Iran. Imam Khamenei has said very clearly that British Shiism, i.e. Western manufactured Shiism or religious ideology, is also a factor. And they use this largely as a psychological operation, you know, using the media. This is very, very, they're very clever at this. The US satellite media has hundreds and hundreds of propaganda platforms to advertise against Iran, to pump up the public against the Islamic Republic of Iran, to say that it's failing, that it isn't able to handle itself in a sort of a civilized way. This is all part of the propaganda that's also been going on. They've used every means necessary to try and really isolate Iran in that sense.
Well, that's the whole thing that Iran's leader was also talking about, in addition to what we've covered, Elijah Magner, and that's the whole notion of Iranophobia. Of course, that's been going on for quite some time. But it's interesting the way that the U.S., if you can expand on this for us, if you agree, has created this Iranophobia as a tool to generate money. We know that the U.S. is always after vilifying a country, and, Iran's been on that list, maybe in the number one spot for quite some time. We're in the region, Iranophobia through the U.S. has generated billions of dollars in military sales. Doesn't that hold true?
Yes, it is true, because creating Iranophobia with the support of the countries of the Middle East, particularly the Gulf countries, the U.S. has succeeded in implementing this Iranophobia in the leadership among the Arabs to push them to buy more weapons and to allow more military bases in the country. So this is how the Americans managed to implant military bases around Iran, under the excuse of Iran creating a danger, potential danger, when Iran never attacked any Arab country since 1979. So if we look, I mean, we should not be surprised here in the West to look at Iran supporting the Palestinian Sunni in Gaza, supporting the Syrian and President Assad, where the majority are Sunni, supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon, supporting Iraq, and particularly when General Qasem Soleimani first supported the Kurd in Kurdistan, and then the Sunnis in Al-Anbar and the Shia in the south and in Baghdad, and then supporting the people in Venezuela. So we understand that Iran has gone beyond the religion, and that is extremely dangerous to the American objective and plans in the world. Today, the Americans are fighting the Russian and the Chinese for their hegemony. So Iran is standing in the way, giving an example for the last 43 years.